We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, sitting in for David Inge. Our guest is historian Nathaniel Philbrick. The award-winning author's latest book revolves around two warriors and their roles in what would become an iconic event in our history, the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Philbrick says the battle marked two last stands, as even in victory, the leaders of the Sioux and Cheyenne nations would soon be confined to Indian reservations. He also says he realized near the end of his research that, in his words, nothing ended at the Little Bighorn. Nathaniel Philbrick's latest book is The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. In the course of his research for this book, Philbrick looked at Private Peter Thompson's account of the battle. Thompson won a Medal of Honor for bravery at the Little Bighorn. His account was written shortly after the battle. Philbrick also examined pictograms drawn by Indians of the battle, and he traveled on several occasions to what is now the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this morning. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Nathaniel Philbrick's previous books include In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award, Mayflower, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and Sea of Glory. That book was awarded the Roosevelt Naval History Prize. Those books, as well as his latest, The Last Stand, are available from Viking. You'll find our guest, Nathaniel Philbrick, and his blog at the website, nathanielphilbrick.com. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. Nathaniel Philbrick, good to talk with you again. How are you?
Good. Good to talk with you again, Celeste.
In the preface to this book, The Last Stand, you say, nothing ended at the Little Bighorn. What do you mean, and how did you come to that point of view?
Well, this is a battle that, as you said earlier, is an iconic part of American history. And it's a battle that every American generation seems to reinterpret in its own way. And I think one of the reasons nothing has ended at the Battle of Little Bighorn is that a mystery surrounds it. Since everyone under Custer's command was killed, we'll never know exactly what happened. There were plenty of Native participants who would provide testimony, but in the conditions of that battle, no one really knew who was who, and so a mystery presides over it. But I think even more important, it came at a moment in America's history, 1876, just as America is celebrating the centennial of its glorious birth. The news hits the nation that America's greatest Indian fighter has been killed to a man when it comes to his own immediate command. And so this created a ripple effect that we're still feeling today, because Custer was a volatile figure, a lightning rod, but his opponent, Sitting Bull, was equally iconic. And so I think this is a battle that is still being debated and will continue to be debated as long as there is a nation of the United States.
Yeah. Now, on the one hand, Custer has been painted as a hero of the Civil War and of the Indian Wars. He's also been painted as an ugly American. And he also was a soldier following orders. Who do you think Custer was?
Well, you know, I sort of went through a whole process. And I first learned about Custer as a freshman in high school. I saw the movie Little Big Man. And Custer in that movie is a deranged maniac, a warmonger. And sort of that's where I began. And but when I was the research in this book, I became surprised by, you know, he was much more than that. You know, we think of him today as sort of history's biggest loser, someone who a wild-eyed warrior that brought his fate upon himself. But the more I got to research his life, I began to realize he was much more complex than this. He was very well read. He was a very good writer. His best friend in the world was not a fellow general. It was a Shakespearean actor named Lawrence Barrett. And, you know, we also have a tendency, since he is such an iconic figure, we think, you know, he sort of strode through history and did exactly what he wanted to in his... But the fact of the matter is, he was a human being in the military taking orders. And so, you know, he would not always obey those orders, but I was impressed by how much he was buffeted by the fates at this point. He was in trouble with the Grant administration, his own officers, it's the great thing about history. It's not always the way we think it is. It's much more interesting.
Sitting Bull, also an iconic figure. What would you like to say here early on about him?
Well, you know, I came away from this book with immense respect for him in terms of how he emerged in an extraordinary time to lead his people in a way that really probably no one else was capable of that time. And I had sort of assumed, I think, with a lot of Americans, that, you know, Sitting Bull was known as the last of his tribe to surrender, a warrior to the end. But I was surprised to learn that as the first shots were being fired at the battle, his initial response was not to attack them, but to actually send out an emissary and say, wait a minute, maybe they want to talk. And so his first reflex, really, in this battle was negotiation, and I found that very intriguing.
So this could have ended very differently.
Absolutely. You know, we think of this as, you know, that the war in history that was inevitable, but it wasn't by any means. It didn't have to happen. And, you know, not only did Sitting Bull want to pursue a possible negotiation, but Custer, in his earlier life on the plains, had shown a remarkable talent for negotiation when he was in Kansas with the Cheyenne. He sort of ended that chapter in his life by bringing the tribe in to the reservation, and so, you know, both sides had that potential to negotiate rather than to fight. But if, you know, if they had done that, we probably wouldn't be talking about this event, and Custer would probably not be the iconic figure he is today.
Yeah, that was very interesting to learn that about Custer, that when he was in Kansas, thanks to a letter that appeared in the newspaper, he changed his view of what was to be done with the Indians. He was criticized by one of his fellow officers, Frederick Benteen, who got this thing into the newspaper anonymously. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the media was such a part of American history at this time, and, you know, just as much as it is today. And one of his officers, Frederick Benteen, did not like him. Most of the people in his regiment were fans of Custer's, but there were a few very notable exceptions. And Frederick Benteen was probably top of the list when it came to despising Custer. And Custer's initial reputation in the West was based on the Battle of the Washita, in which he took Black Kettle's village and was able to extract his regiment with 50 hostages, even though they were almost wiped out by a much larger village down the river. But in the process, they lost track of one of his officers, they later found out had been he and his men had been wiped out and their bodies mutilated. And Benteen, who was a friend of this officer, wrote an anonymous letter to the St. Louis newspaper that was reprinted, and Custer got word of it, was outraged, but it seems to have had an impact on him, because America was divided as to what to do in these Indian wars. You know, do we fight them? Do we negotiate? You know, and Custer was immediately branded both a hero and, you know, that he had unnecessarily attacked this village. So he went into sort of high spin doctor mode and sort of changed his behavior completely. And in his next encounter with the Cheyenne, instead of attacking, he decided to negotiate, a really nervy game of brinksmanship. And he was very proud of the fact that when he did bring this group of Cheyenne into the reservation, he had done it not by attacking, but by talking, and wrote very proudly about this in his own book, My Life on the Plains. And so, Custer was, he was cagey, and he was working his image all the time.
This is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this morning, historian Nathaniel Philbrick. His latest book is The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Or you can join us by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's take a call from a listener now in Cisna Park, waiting for us on line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking the call. A great show, very interesting topic. I agree with your guest. It was a fascinating time in American history. Just as a sidebar, believe it or not, when this was going on, the Chicago Cubs were actually already playing baseball. So you have this diverse nation going on, the East versus the West. It was just fascinating. I read a book a number of years ago about the battle, and actually, as the author did, I visited the Little Bighorn. And what I was struck by was almost like Pickett's Charge. You know, what were they thinking? Mm-hmm. I don't know if your guest wants to talk about the strategy behind the battle, but I don't understand why Custer, I believe he separated his troops to the point where I think at the final battle they were outnumbered something like almost 100-1. I mean, there was no way that they were ever going to win that battle, and I don't know, maybe there was a strategy behind Custer's plans there. But the other thing I wanted to comment was, your guest touched on it, was the mutilation of the bodies. In a battle with the Sioux, I believe it was a spirit thing where they had to mutilate the body to get rid of the bad spirit or something. It was quite gruesome. But I'll mention those two things and I'll ring off and I'll listen. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yes, well, having visited the battle battlefield five times now, I really, you get a sense of how topography really determined so much in this battle, because Custer, about noon of June 25th, 1876, knew there was a big Indian village, but he couldn't see it. And what his scouts told him was that the village was beginning to scatter, that it was a big village, but it was beginning to fall apart as the warriors and the non-combatants moved in various directions. And so in an attempt to try to surround them to keep the villagers from leaving, he split up his regiment into three battalions. It was really four groups because there was also the slow-moving pack train. And so initially he was trying to surround what he thought was a dispersing village, only to belatedly discover that, no, it was not dispersing at all. And there were 8,000 Native Americans there, approximately 2,000 warriors. And by the time he could get a visual on this village, they were basically almost upon it. And having divided up his regiment, Lakota and Cheyenne were able to defeat each battalion individually. And there's really three battles in one when it comes to this, the Battle of Little Bighorn. And Custer's battalion of about 210 soldiers was isolated on the other side of a bluff, so the others couldn't see what had happened to him. But they were wiped out to a man. And the others many of them would survive in an infamous siege of 2 days. And so it was Indian fighting on the plains was difficult because the mobility of the Lakota and Cheyenne meant that they could scatter in minutes and elude a fast-moving cavalry regiment. So So Custer, in his attempt to handle that phenomenon, unwittingly made it so that they could really do what happened and defeat his battalion completely and almost kill off the entire regiment.
Hmm. And any comment about the mutilation?
Yeah, the mutilation was shocking to many of the survivors, obviously, but it was a regular part of native warfare, particularly in this instance where these warriors were outraged. They had basically the village had just been sitting there, and they were interested in negotiation, but the cavalry officers weren't. And it was also thought that a brave warrior, a brave soldier, was often more mutilated than a non-one, apparently. But it was a part of the culture of this warfare, and so it was shocking to behold when 2 days later the survivors came across the Custer portion of the battlefield. But it was something that they had seen in previous battles, and that, you know, and to be honest, the U.S. Army soldiers were known to also do mutilations of their own.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Belgium on line one. Hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Jill. I'd like to make a couple of points about times in the 1870s. You mentioned earlier about this one account. The fellow who wrote it got the Congressional Medal of Honor for it. We have to realize that today the Congressional Medal of Honor is something of extremely high value and everything. But of the several thousand that have been awarded, the highest percentage of them were awarded from the Civil War to slightly about the time you have there. And they were given out sometimes with less than meritorious benefits. You know, sometimes whole groups got it just because the effort they made was, you know, exemplary, but some, not individuals, were given it the way that, if you understand what I'm saying, they threw them out quite willy-nilly at that time. The other thing I wanted to point out to you is that even though, you know, Custer might want to negotiate with these people, there was still the aspect that the American philosophy at that time was essentially genocide. They wanted to remove all the native peoples off of all the land, especially any land that they thought was productive, for their own uses. So no matter if Custer would have negotiated and came to a fair understanding, shortly thereafter things would have changed around and been completely nullified. I'd like to hear your comments on those.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you're right. You know, if they had negotiated, it would not have turned out well at all for the Lakota and Cheyenne. But, you know, and there would not have been this climactic battle that has become such a part of our history. And, you know, and just to talk about a little bit about the motivations for this campaign, this particular campaign against the Lakota and Cheyenne, I think, you know, a lot of Americans think of these Indian wars as the cavalry defending pioneers and things like that. But the motivations behind this particular battle were very different, because gold had just been discovered in the Black Hills in what's now South Dakota by none other than Custer during an expedition in 1874. And almost immediately, this region, which was sacred to the Lakota and native land legally, was overswarmed with prospectors. And the Grant administration decided, well, we can't get the miners off the land. We better buy the land from the Lakota, but the Lakota refused to sell. And so rather than waging war against the miners, Grant decided to wage war against the Lakota, force them onto the reservations, and negotiate the sale of the Black Hills. So, you know, this was a battle that was really a trumped-up excuse force a sale of land for gold. And so, you know, it's not a good story when it comes to the government's motivations at this time in our history.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call this morning. How did the last stand at the Little Bighorn lay the groundwork for what you call the second last stand?
Yeah, well, you know, this was, and Sitting Bull was well aware of this, that when you win a big victory, the cry for vengeance is huge. And that's exactly what happened when word reached the East Coast on July 7th, 1876, that, you know, that Custer had suffered this disastrous defeat. Congress was able to push through funding that they never could have done previously as far as the military, and new groups of soldiers were brought into the area. The forts were built on what had been native land, and within a year, just about all the native leaders and their tribes had been forced onto the reservations. And, you know, and it was not just a product of military might. The other factor, which was probably even bigger than victories and defeats on the battlefield when it came to bringing the Native American, forcing the Native Americans onto the reservations, was that their food supply, the buffalo, were being decimated by the push west, by the building of railroads. And so that last summer of 1876 was really the last summer of a plentiful buffalo supply. And as the harassment from the soldiers became unrelenting and the buffalo began to disappear, there was really no other options.
Hmm. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, Nathaniel Philbrick, author most recently of The Last Stand. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Robinson on line 4. Hello.
Hello, Celeste. I would like to give an admonition to your author. I respect his research, and in general, I am quite in agreement with his conclusions. But he should, when he goes out to speak on tours, learn the difference between cavalry and cavalry. Cavalry are mounted troops. Cavalry is the mountain upon which Jesus was crucified. He's in distinguished company because George W. Bush, despite his professed deep Christianity, also says cavalry.
Thank you. Cavalry. You got it.
And let's take another call. Listener on line 1, Effingham. Hi.
I finished a book, The Trail of Tears, some years back, and some allusions in the book, if I'm correct about the book, was the an Englishman came from England and shot 20,000 buffalo a day to deprive, you know, the life, the continuity of Native American life and their food supply, and the activities of the famous Kit Carson, who tracked Navajo, I think it was, up into the mountains, starving them to death. These activities are less than heroic. I mean, the colonialism of the Westerners who traveled over here after Columbus beat the path is a horror story, I think, of the magnitude that is almost inconceivable today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the victories of Western influence adopted from the Greeks and Romans is just heinous in its, the story is heinous. Thank you, and I'll ring off.
Okay. Care to comment?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, when we look back on the pattern of America's push west, it is a terrible story. And but for those that were caught up in it, they saw the West as a land of potential opportunity. They wanted the land and had a tendency, as many opportunistic nations do, to put their own needs ahead of the people that are already there. And it's very interesting when you look at the responses at that time. the country was divided. The Westerners who wanted that land felt that this was these wars and this push was part of their destiny. The Easterners, who were caught up in a very different economic situation, looked at it in much as the caller just summed it up. And so the nation was profoundly divided. And when it came to the military, they didn't feel good about these wars. Particularly if you were a veteran of the Civil War, this was a war fought for all the right reasons. And then to go, as Custer did, then to move out into the wars of the West, where you were attacking villages of non-combatants, taking hostages, killing innocent women and children. These were wars that no one really felt good about. And I think it's something like, we had World War II, a similar thing, where the good war, and then Vietnam, where everything was blurred in terms of good and bad. It was just not a conflict that reflected well on the United States. And I think the Western wars were very much like that. And this is one of the reasons why we're still talking about it. It's a very troubling time in our history. And yet so many of our American myths of heroism, of fighting it out in a blaze of glory, come from that time. And I think it's important to probe underneath those iconic images and say, what really was going on.
Mm-hmm. We have an email question for you. This listener would like to know if you feel there was cause to believe one of the officers could have made a difference in the battle. And I believe this listener is referring to Major Marcus Reno.
Yeah. I mean, one of the fascinating things about this battle are the characters of the officers, particularly when it comes to those directly beneath Custer. There is Marcus Reno, who was a major, and he led the first charge into a village that no one really knew what size or quite exactly where it was. And he was ordered to charge into the village. And instead of charging into it, he stopped, put out what was known as a skirmish line, and in doing that, allowed the warriors to pull themselves together and drive his men off the field and up into a hill where a siege began. And if he had charged into the village, would it have been differently? It turned out differently. Who knows? And then there is also Captain Frederick Benteen, who we mentioned earlier, who Custer had sent a message to him. He had been sent out to the left in pursuit of possible Indians heading in that direction. Custer sent him a message saying, "Come on, quick! This is a big village. I need all the ammunition you can get, and obviously your men." And instead of doing that, Benteen stopped where Reno had been forced to, up on that bluff, and hung out with Reno for an hour or so before reluctantly making his way towards Custer, where he could see in the distance something was going on. But by then it was too late. Custer had already been defeated, and the siege began. And so it's a battle that has three key personalities when it comes to the officers of the 7th Cavalry. And you have to, each one had his own culpability, I think. And it's intriguing to see how it worked out and potentially influence the outcome of the battle.
Let's take another telephone call now. Champagne, line two, hi.
Good morning. My question is why you've concentrated on Sitting Bull for the Native American side. Sometimes I've heard him described more as a spiritual leader than a war chief. And, of course, Crazy Horse is often given a lot of credit. And in general, Native Americans had more of a collective leadership than a single leader, and I'm curious why you made that choice.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, it's clear that, the Native American psyche was not one to have a strong leader. It was consensual, government-wise, but at this particular moment in their cultural history, as the white forces were coming, it's clear that there was a decision to put one leader forward to decide, as they said, when we should fight and when we should not fight. And Crazy Horse, so Sitting Bull was elevated to a position whereby he was, you know, a spiritual leader, but he was also consulted as far as to, you know, what do we do next? And Crazy Horse was the foremost warrior of the tribe. And in my book, I talk about how in the years and weeks and the months and weeks before the battle, it was Sitting Bull was seems to have been the focal figure in which Native Americans from the reservations came left the reservations to find Sitting Bull's village on the Rosebud, and then once the battle began and fighting was seen as the only option, Crazy Horse definitely took a leading role in the actual battle. But I've chosen to focus on Sitting Bull because I felt he was a character that he was a figure that personalized in many ways the entire Native experience at this moment in a way that was an interesting contrast with that of Custer.
Listener, want to follow up?
Well, thank you. That's a good answer. I had one brief question about weaponry. The Army refused to adopt repeating rifles mm-hmm. at that time because they said they wasted ammunition. the Native Americans had repeating weapons, and Custer had the option of taking a Gatling gun with him but said it was too heavy and left it at home. So there were a number of things going against the Army, but one of them was they had inferior weapons.
Absolutely. And, you know, what was incredible to me is, as you were saying, they were trying to save money by having single-shot weaponry. And they also did as little target practice as possible. Some of these soldiers had only fired their weapons a handful of times. And in fact, Peter Thompson, who we referred to earlier, told his daughter that he was actually scared spitless of his Springfield 73. It was a powerful weapon that he really didn't know that much about. And so to find yourself in the middle of this terrible battle with a weapon that you're unfamiliar with and not terribly proficient at, when your enemies have repeating weapons, someone is able to fire 17 rounds without reloading, you're going to be in a tough situation. And so technology would become a huge part of determining what happened with this battle.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. Listener in Peoria on line 4. Hello.
Hi. When you were talking about Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, what I was in my limited reading of this history, I was so impressed with the person of Gall.
Mm-hmm.
Could you comment on him?
Yes. Gall plays a large part in my telling of the actual battle. Gall was a hunkpapa, as was Sitting Bull. And he learned very early in the battle, actually even before Reno's portion of it began, there were some Lakota noncombatants who were killed, perhaps by Crow or Arikara scouts. And two of his wives and three of Gall's children were of this group that were killed. And so he heard early on in the fighting that he had, you know, suffered this terrible loss. And so he, as he said, would later say, my heart was bad with revenge. And he would take a major role during Custer's portion of the battle in trying to secure the soldiers' horses, because without the horses, the soldiers would be defenseless. And so Gall went after the horses. And if you go to the battlefield, it's as you're driving through it, there is a portion of it still called today Horseholders Ravine. And this is where a large portion of Custer's battalion's horses were kept as the others were fighting on foot. And Gall seems to have been the one to strike there, and the panicked horses fled, leaving the soldiers at the mercy of the Lakota. So Gall played a very big role in this battle. And in my telling, I really tried to focus as best I could on the individual soldiers and warriors, because, you know, there is the overarching story of Custer and Sitting Bull, but all of these warriors had, on both sides, had extraordinary experiences, and I try to bring those to life in my telling of the battle.
Want to follow up? No, I think the caller is gone. One of the many interesting facets of this story is Private Peter Thompson's account of the battle, and you note that there are problems with his account, but that the essence of it is useful. This was an account that was set down not long after the battle. His daughter Susan wrote her father's words down, and they were published in 1914. Tell us a little bit about Peter Thompson and his account of the battle.
Yeah, it's an account that's controversial in that it was originally published almost 40 years after the battle, and Thompson, in telling his story, not only included what he had seen, but some of the stories he had heard, and some of these were clearly not true, apocryphal stories. So that his narrative is, in some cases, it seems crystal clear and right on. Other times, you're going, what is he talking about here? And, there's an obvious tendency to dismiss it. But from the beginning, when I read it, I thought, this reflects in so many ways the reality of battle, which is to be completely confused and bewildered. And yet it has very specific details that over the years, researchers have found corroborating evidence for. So Thompson's account is made a kind of comeback, and through the help of a researcher named Rocky Boyd, who recently passed away tragically, I was able to get access to this account written by Thompson's daughter, in which she talks about the process by which Thompson wrote his narrative. And it turns out that Thompson had begun keeping notes about the battle within months of 1876. And so, instead of being the reminiscences of an old man, this account was based on details that he had written down at the time. And so, for me, Thompson's account, he claimed to see Custer on his horse Vic beside the Little Bighorn by himself only a half hour or so before Custer's portion of the battle began. And people have said, how could this happen? Thompson should have died with Custer, but his horse gave out, and so he was on foot and would eventually make it back to Reno. And so I used Thompson's account as a way to not only say, well, look, we should not dismiss it, but to talk about evidence as an issue, because I think evidence is a huge part of this story. What can we believe? Where did it come from? Even before this battle was over, its participants, particularly Marcus Reno and Frederick Benteen, were already calculating how they should describe what they did. People were aware that this was history even before it was finished. And so that when people started leaving accounts or being interviewed or whatever, there was all sorts of strategies going on. And so much of my book is not only telling the story of the battle, but exploring what we know and what can we believe.
Yeah. In terms of media manipulation and promotion, maybe you'd give us a quick word about Libby Custer.
Yeah, well, Libby was the spin doctor anyone with an ambition to be remembered should have. I mean, Libby was fiercely ambitious, and her ambition worked through her husband. She felt George Custer should be remembered for all time, and she would... after the Battle of Little Bighorn, she would live on into her 90s. She wouldn't die until the 1930s, and she made it her life's work to defend her husband. She would write three different accounts of three books about their experiences in the West together. She made sure that Lieutenant Godfrey, who was became the unofficial historian of the battle when he wrote a narrative of the battle, kept his account in line with what she wanted him to say. And so she was very savvy and helped to create an image of Custer as a hero that in many instances lives on today.
Hmm. What light do the Indian drawings of the battle shed on Little Bighorn? You've included some of them in your book.
Yeah, well, I was one of the great surprises in this whole endeavor was that how much seeing influenced my understanding of the battle, going to the battlefield, studying the topography, the photographs that were taken of the participants. But first and foremost were the native pictographs, and these are very detailed drawings that stylized in their own way, but based on the warriors' memories of what happened. And in many instances, wasn't just one warrior's perspective, because to accumulate battle honors, you had to have what were known as your coups verified by others. And so these pictographs provide, they're not only beautiful, but they provide very specific evidence of the battle, of, you know, how the warriors were dressed, how the horses were outfitted, and I do include them in my book. And I think there's something, since the written evidence is so ambiguous and in some cases controversial, the visual evidence is all the more important.
Yeah. After three books focused on our early history and its relation to the sea, you turned your gaze west, and you mentioned the movie you saw in high school, but that took hold of you and it remained with you. But why did you eventually decide this would be a project that you would take up as a historian?
Well, it was really my last book before this, Mayflower, which is the story of the iconic story of the Pilgrims, with which a lot of Americans think of American history beginning. And the end of that ends with a cataclysmic Native English conflict known as King Philip's War. And after writing that book, I thought, okay, so this is the iconic beginning. Where does it lead? Well, you know, if there's an iconic end to the process of America being settled on its eastern shore and pushing west, it's the Battle of Little Bighorn. And my earlier books are primarily sea-focused, but Mayflower really only had one chapter at sea. And one of the arguments in all of my books prior to this has been that, you know, before there was the wilderness of the West, there was the wilderness of the sea. We Americans feel that a wilderness is essential to who we are, exploration and vistas on which to push into. I wanted to see the continuities between what I had explored in my previous books and this most landlocked of stories, and it's been amazing to me how the continuities I've found. Not only is the vastness of the West incredibly oceanic in terms of, I think, what it does to human behavior, but also the rivers are a huge part of the story in my telling. There is even a boat, the Far West, a riverboat, that was critical to supplying the regiment with provisions and weapons, and also brought back first word of the disaster when the battle was over. So for me, this, instead of, you know, going off in a different direction, this has felt much more like a culmination.
Yeah. And boy, it was a rough life on the rivers.
Oh, gosh. You know, this is part of the reasons they had to use a riverboat was there was no railroad yet across Montana. And so they had to get this 190-foot riverboat up the Missouri, where it took a left and went up the Yellowstone, and then eventually took another left up the Bighorn River, which is not a big river. But they, Grant Marsh, the captain, was able to push this big vessel all the way up to the its confluence with the Little Bighorn River, which is basically a creek. and so for me, this was an integral part of the story that most of us don't know anything about when it comes to the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Let's take another call, a listener in Pasotum on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. I hate to ask this question. Listening to you is much more fascinating, but it jarred my memory banks. Back probably in the 50s, there was a Disney movie called Comanche about a surviving horse. Was there any truth to that? And I guess that's all. I'll listen off air. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thanks for the call.
Oh, well, thank you, because Comanche is one of my favorite characters in the story. And I think I saw that movie as well. And I've talked to a lot of people since who were that was the movie that sort of got them going on this story. And, yes, Comanche was ridden by Captain Miles Keogh, an Irishman. And Comanche was found, referred to as the only living thing found in the vicinity of Last Stand Hill. He had been wounded seven times, including by a shotgun blast that apparently had broken Keogh's leg. And Comanche was nursed back to help, was actually transported back to Fort Lincoln, which was the base camp of the 7th Cavalry just below Bismarck in what's now North Dakota. Comanche was transported back on the far west and would recover from his injuries and become the pampered pet of the regiment. And the horses in the are as much characters in some ways in my telling as the human beings. I mean, it's just amazing. There's a private Roman Rutten's horse panics during Reno's charge and goes into the village, but Roman's able to get him back out and actually circumnavigates Reno's battalion three times during the charge. And there's a mule named Barnum that falls down a cliff with ammunition on his saddle and somehow survives. These are important part of the story. And just as a footnote, Comanche still lives in a way. He is stuffed at the Natural History Museum, the University of Kansas in Lawrence, and I even made the pilgrimage out there. And if any of your listeners want to see Comanche, go down to Kansas.
Another caller waiting for us. Champagne, line two, hi.
Hi. I appreciate your careful accounting, and it sounds like you've done some really careful research, and it sounds pretty balanced. I've been out to the Pine Ridge Reservation four times in the last decade working on housing there, and I would like to point out that one reason the story is still relevant is not only because we're still talking about it, but because some of the abuse or institutional abuse toward the Indians is still occurring.
Absolutely.
And the land is still being taken. You know, originally I think it was Jefferson said everything west of Missouri they could have.
Right.
But then, of course, when gold was discovered, the sacred Black Hills were taken. And there is one example. There is a firing range. There was a firing range, I think, that was established during World War II in the Badlands. And when it was then decommissioned, it wasn't returned to the Indians because it was their land. It was made into a national park. And this is just another example of land grab. And there was also a time, I'm not sure when this was, but sometime in the 20th century, I believe, when the government decided that the Indians were too sparsely populated, so they were allotted, I forget how many acres it was per head of household, which they conceived of as the male, which was not always the way the Indians saw it. And So there was a lot of land grabbed then, and there are non-Indians living on the reservation and living in those counties that the reservations constitute that have a lot of power. So maybe you could talk some about that.
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And, you know, for those peoples, the battle is as relevant today as it was then because the injustices continue. We were just talking about the Missouri River. Well, there was the decision to dam that in the 50s, and that flooded much of the most fertile land in the reservations along the Missouri and was, you know, a disastrous occurrence. And the injustices continue. I spent, I traveled to the Standing Rock Sioux Agency, to Pine Ridge, and you know, this is a living part of the country's legacy. And you know, we had our own version of colonialism. It's just what happened in our own interior, and we're living with those consequences every day. And I think it's important that we understand that what occurred in the 19th century when it came to America's push west and the treatment of the Native Americans is still a part of this nation.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for her call this morning. It seems to me here that we've got another parallel between the story that unfolds in your book, Mayflower, and the story that unfolds here, in that in our pursuit of liberty and justice, we often get it wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, what makes America great is, I think, that we get it wrong, but we then do not we return to it and recognize the injustices and hopefully begin to deal with them, and that's our only hope as a nation in the future. But that's why I think these myths are important to revisit, because you know, people have taken strengths from them in the past, but I think the reality of what happened needs to be addressed.
There, we'll wrap it up because we're here at the end of time, and I think that's a good point to leave the story.
It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Celeste.
Well, thank you for talking with me this morning. I really enjoyed it, and as I have in the past, we've talked on a number of occasions, albeit on a different program. And listeners, I will let you know that if you'd like to hear other interviews with Nathaniel Philbrook, visit our website, will.illinois.edu. They are archived there. Nathaniel Philbrook's latest book, The Last Stand, Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of the Little Bighorn, is just out. It hits the bookstores tomorrow. It is published by Viking. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn.